This episode of The Review was first broadcast on the 4th of February 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be hearing what's flying off the shelves in independent bookstores in Sydney, Washington and Malmo.
We are specialised in Swedish books, of course, and English books. I think it's because of that we can survive.
And we'll also be getting some musical recommendations from Turkey by music journalist and DJ Mersen.
And we'll be working our way through a stack of great magazines with John Walters, editor of I, the International Review of Graphic Design, who'll be joining us live in studio.
And of course, we'll also be talking to our man in Budapest, Adam Labor, about the exhibition celebrating the man who saved tens of thousands of Jews from Nazi persecution, Raoul Wallenberg, right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias.
Hello, Tyler.
I'm moving into hour four, hour five now.
I was going to say, have you been enjoying being a DJ in the house today?
It's actually just Saturday morning coming in here is absolutely fantastic because it's just, there was two studio engineers in and security and John Escombe doing the news. And it's great.
And did you spend Friday night with a glass of wine going through your CD collection, curating our morning listening?
I would like to say that I did, but in fact, it was more like getting up at 7 and having a scramble around the flat and arriving almost breathless and getting the time check wrong at 8 a.m. But no, it was fine. I actually had a wonderful evening visiting some friends at their very nice apartment in St. James and met a really interesting gentleman who we're going to be having on the program at some point, who was ex-British Army. And I was mentioning him earlier, in fact, and just really amazing stories. I don't want to give away what we're going to be working on, but it involves defense cuts and what it means for this country. And you?
Intriguing. I just very quiet after my time away, just sort of getting on.
You had
a
quiet Friday evening.
I did have a very quiet Friday, which I really loved. Very quiet.
No, I was wanting that as well because it's been a combination of course hosting with Tom Burgess Watson this week, and then we had the BBC correspondent thing, which was on. It was on Thursday night, which was a very, very late night until 3:30, and then having to be back in here with some German publishers bright and early on Friday morning.
And are you flying anywhere?
I'm leaving. No, I'm going. I'm off to Singapore. I'm off to Singapore from tomorrow, and Singapore. Then I'm going to Seoul, and then up to Tokyo, down to Fukuoka, back up to Tokyo. I was saying earlier in the program that we're doing two small events this week. So we're doing a small little party in Seoul, and then one in Tokyo. It kicks off our fifth anniversary season, because as you know, that issue is fast upon us, and you've got a film coming up as well.
I do have a film. I'm going to try and encapsulate in 3 minutes 5 years of Monocle.
And how's it going so far?
So far, so good. Stay tuned.
Excellent. Okay, wonderful.
Okay, well, you are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
Well, it's time for our regular segment. And of course, I think everyone knows by this point that we love to support independent businesses. By the way, did you see that, speaking of independent shops, and I've referred to them before, over on the High Street, very close to here on Marylebone High Street, Lewis & Lewis, which was the most wonderful store. I mean, actually, that's why there are no light bulbs in these studios on the table, because our favorite, light bulb and vacuum bag and screwdriver and hammer shop, gone.
And it's going to be another fashion boutique.
I'm sure it's going to be another fashion boutique. I'm not sure if they got shoved out by the landlords or if it was a question of just key money that they couldn't say no to. But it's the last thing that we need is another candle shop here anyway. But we're going to start with a review of independent bookshops around the world. Gillian.
And first up, we are going to Malmö in Sweden, where our reporter, Nicholas Wakeham, went to Gmud Harulis, bear with me there, owner of the Hamrelius bookshop, which has been open since 1991.
It's in the center of Malmö, and we started 8 years ago in this spot. And we have, it's about 1,000 square meters in two levels. We are specialized in Swedish books, of course, and English books. I think it's because of that we can survive. Today we have a great competition from other sources. We have a Swedish author, his name is Björn Ranelid, And he has written a very good book about Malmö in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He got very good reviews for that one. Our greatest hit during the last 2-3 months is a book about a Swedish football player who plays in Italy, in Milan. His name is Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and we sold something around 800-900 copies. The future for the booksellers in Sweden is very difficult because we don't know really that we can go on. We have internet today, and you can sell books in grocery stores, you can sell books everywhere, and some are just having books just to get people to come to the shops and don't care if they don't owe any money. An English book. I have one about written by Robert Goddard, which I'm looking forward to read that one, because Goddard is one of my favorites. But of course, I would like to read Ian McEwan, but I've read all the books by him.
And that was Gudmund Hamrelius, owner of the Hamrelius Bookshop in Malmö in Sweden. He sounded incredibly cozy, didn't he? Anyway, next it's down to Sydney, where Joel Tozer went along to Magnation, a magazine shop I know very well. And they've got branches in Sydney, Melbourne, and Auckland. They stock over 4,000 titles.
Hi, my name is Michael, and for the last 4 to 5 years I've been working for Magnation. My role in Sydney is manager store in Sydney, but I've also been involved in the expansion of the brand and of the company in the last few years across Australia and New Zealand. Initially we started out with one little store in New Zealand. I guess it was a mum and pa store. And from there, in 2006, we opened up our main store, our flagship store in Melbourne CBD. And from there, we've opened up a few more stores. I guess we've got 3 in New Zealand now and 3 in Australia, so we've got 6 stores. Newtown's actually a pretty gritty inner west suburb, and we get a lot of eclectic kind of mix of people coming in here. Anything from the fashion crowd to the design crowds, but also a lot of business people as well, and a lot of artists as well come in here. We wanted to create something that was a little bit different to maybe what normal stores are like, and we wanted to create a really nice environment where people can come into and feel really comfortable staying and reading magazines and not feel pressured to buy them. It's more about not having the biggest range, it's more about having a nicely curated range and taking care of what you actually stock rather than having everything. I guess we've developed relations with various publishers of independent titles, and we really look to see what's selling really well across, I guess, Europe and America, but also Australia. So we've sort of tailored our range to suit, I guess, what sells well, what we know is going to sell well, but also what suits the type of people that buy magazines in Australia. Some of the titles that are most popular in our store, which are in our favourites unit, that are Australian, would be things like the Smith Journal, Frankie Magazine, Monster Children, Empty Magazine is really nice. It's a really nice kids magazine called Paper Mache. And on an international scale, we've got selling really well right now would be things like Apartamento, Port Magazine, A Magazine. It's not just magazines. I guess we've had to evolve the concept a little bit over the last few years. So we've really kind of gone into high-end stationery as well to complement the magazine range. I know we stock a lot of stuff like German stationery, German pens, Rodia, Moleskine, Delphonics, and also accessories. So we stock a lot of Pantone accessories for your iPad or whatever. We found we did have to adapt the range a little bit for that. There are definitely a lot of people that still want to read magazines. I mean, I'm more surprised than anyone else that we've seen growth over the last couple of years in the store, and that there's still a huge desire for print. It's really, really good to see.
That was Michael Getty, store manager of Magnation in Newtown, Sydney. Next, we're moving continent again to the Americas, where reporter Amy Blazek visited Politics and Prose store in Washington, D.C.
My name is Lissa Muscatine. I'm one of the co-owners of Politics and Prose with my husband, Bradley Graham. We're into our 8th month, so we're new, very new. It's been great. We're really having fun. The store has really been doing well. We had a huge fall and just amazing November and December, which was great, and we're hoping we haven't peaked too soon. But yeah, so far so good. I would say that Politics and Prose is set apart as an independent from a lot of what's going on in the book industry because, among other things, we have expert booksellers. They're really curators of our inventory. We have, as I mentioned, 475 author events a year with both great emerging authors but also the best-known authors. We also offer courses and classes. We have a print-on-demand machine for people in the community to self-publish books as well as to be able to print out rare books and hard-to-find books in 5 minutes. Let's just go to the front because that's where we have our event books, which are not necessarily this week, but they're pretty recent. And I will point out one of our staff favorites in a second, but if we go this way to the front, people are coming in and browsing as we walk through. But this shelving here has the books that will be having events this week or next week. So, for example, tomorrow night we have All the Missing Souls by David Sheffin. And if you're into politics, next week we're going to have one of our many political events with a Harvard University professor who's written about the Tea Party and Republican conservatism. So those are among the new books that are out. This is our fiction wall. So you can see we list our store bestsellers. We have 12 at any given time. These are fiction, and on the opposite wall are the nonfiction. This is really one of our super favorite books right now. It's called The Orphan Master's Son. It's by a guy named Adam Johnson. We have a fantastic children's section downstairs, which hopefully you've been to. The big kid book of the year is The Hunger Games. That's just, and even adults are reading that, and it's sort of a paranormal kind of thriller. So, you know, nobody can keep that in stock. One of the things that was fascinating to us over, this was our first Christmas season here, this store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books. Now that said, we're preparing for the inevitability that ebooks are going to become a greater share of the market and that some people want them, period. Some people just want them for convenience when they're traveling. Whatever their reason for wanting them, we want to sell them. We do sell them. We sell them on our website. We also do online ordering. You can order from this bookstore 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and have a book shipped to you. So we want to compete in those areas, although we serve a very, very different purpose. And one thing that's really important about independence, sort of what makes this store special, and I think it's true of other very good independent bookstores, they're more than bookstores.
And that was Lissa Muscatine, co-owner of Politics and Prose, a new bookstore in Washington. Both owners, Lissa and Bradley Graham, once worked for the Washington Post, and Lissa most recently worked as a speechwriter for Hillary Clinton at both the White House and at the State Department. And yeah, just listening to her, you want to go. I mean, yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of spending too much time in Washington, D.C., but there's something very infectious about the way she was talking about
it. Yeah, and great name, Politics and Prose in Washington.
Brilliant.
Perfect. Okay, well, next up, in our global review, it's time for music. After the break, we'll continue with some of the latest recommendations from the Turkish music scene. Stay with us.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the culture section, our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, wandered around the corner to Daikanyama's hottest new retail experience, Tsutaya. I jumped on the Eurostar to visit Air, making their new album, La Voyage dans la Lune. And there's four cracking album reviews, more of which you can hear on Monocle 24.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias, where it is the review. And it's just coming up to, it's 19 minutes past the hour here in London, 19 minutes past 7 a.m. If you're in New York, Toronto, or Boston.
And it's time for our weekly music review. And today we're joined on the line from Istanbul by Marzen, who is a Turkish music journalist, DJ and blogger, and musical director of the nightclub Mini Musical. Hello, Marzen. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
Very, very good. Can you give us a sense first off? I guess it's a weekend, Friday night. What is the music scene like in Istanbul on a weekend?
Oh, the weekends are quite hectic in Istanbul. Compared to like 10 years ago, there's a lot happening. Maybe it might be consumption-wise the one of the capitals of European nightlife now, maybe compared to London and Berlin.
It's interesting, Mersen.
In quantity, I mean.
Sorry, Marcin, it is quite amazing when we talk to people who are living in the region that if you look even people from the Ukraine and the way that Istanbul has really become a hub again, and particularly as a weekend place. I wanted to just to start by talking about the music curation and the scene. If you're listening to any of the major radio stations, or if you go into record shops, etc., what are the influences right now? Would you say that the Turkish music scene, the Istanbul music scene, is it looking more east, or is it looking more west?
Consumption wise or production wise?
No, more the sound. What is the sound like, and where is it getting its influence from?
I think it's more of a Western sound, as always. As always, for the last 10, 15 years, like the Turkish culture mostly likes to base itself on the Western way. So music-wise, it's somehow a hybrid of West and East, but mostly focusing on the Western ways.
And you say Western, but when it comes to lyrics and stories in the films, do you get a sense what are the young musicians saying in their songs?
Well, just general love songs and stuff, but I'm not really knowledgeable about the lyrics of the general productions. That would be hard for me to say.
And why don't we start? You've lined up a couple of songs for us today, Mersen. And yeah. The first is Artakashmi Yedim, and this is by Erkin Goren. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the artist afterwards. But let's have a listen. And that was Arkadaşımı Yedim by Erkin Goren. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, and we are talking to Mersen, journalist, DJ, blogger, and musical director. And he's on the line from Istanbul. Can you tell us a little bit about Erkin Goren?
Yeah, Erkin is a Wizkid. He's an artist, and he used to own his art gallery. These two albums just caught me unawares. In the last 2 years, he's done these small personal EPs and just released them on Bandcamp. But it's the incorporation of different styles and personal, almost surreal lyrics. It's somehow unprecedented in Turkish music, I guess. Mm. So for me, it's one of the best upcoming young artists.
Mersin, where does Erkin Goren, where does he sit in the Turkish music scene right now? I mean, really seen as up and coming or quite already well recognized?
I don't think he's recognized anyhow in the mainstream. He's just one of these small bedroom producers. The Istanbul music scene is for consumption. It's huge, but my criticism would be it's for production. It's still not up to scale of how a 15 million city would be.
Tell me, how do young artists and young talent get noticed? Is it through live performance, or is it through posting their music on websites?
Both actually. But there are for indie artists and producers, there are only a few venues. The most important might be Peyote. It's also a venue and a nightclub, and it was found by our late friend, whom we lost last year. He was instrumental in finding this new Istanbul scene, which is kind of thriving right now. Maybe not up to scale in production quality, but will be, I guess, in 2 or 3 years. New bands, new bands are forming, and everything revolves around a few venues. But to be recognized on a mainstream level, it's almost impossible for young artists.
In
my opinion.
You've lined up another artist for us, Mersen. This is a Harich Tan Gazeljar, the song is called Yolar. And again, let's have a listen, and then we'll come back and chat about it.
Bir ustamızın havasıdır, ustalarımızın havasıdır. Bir ustamızın havasıdır, ustalarımızın.
And that was Yolar by Harich Tan Gazeljar. And we're talking to Mersen, who is a DJ blogger and journalist. He's on the line from Istanbul. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Gazeljar.
Oh, they're a band from Izmit, a small city, a small industrial city neighboring Istanbul. I think they are one of the... Baba Zula is one of the most famous Istanbul indie bands. They're online with the same aesthetic of taking early like Turkish psychedelics and making something new out of it. More in tune with the traditional style, but very Western in a way in the forms.
And Mersen, a group like that, would their following be largely live, and is that how they would make their name and touring sort of various venues, or are they making their way sort of, you know, online and through underground music press? I mean, how would you gain popularity as an act like that in Turkey?
I think the usual online channels like Facebook and everything would work, but having close ties with the indie community and appearing on some of the noted venues as a live band would really work.
And what about radio? Is there good radio play for young musicians?
There are quite a few small radios. Small independent radios, but which I belong to one of them anyway, Dinamo FM, which is mostly dance oriented. There are also radios for indie rock, but I'm not quite sure if you're a really small bedroom producer or a small band. If it would be easy for you to gain some time slots, but I'm sure there are ways of getting on. But the mainstream radio and mainstream TV is totally out of reach.
Mm. Mersen in Istanbul, teşekkür for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye. Have a good Bye. Weekend. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. When we come back, we're going to dive into our stack of magazines. We're back in a moment.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel. And we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias. It's just coming up to 25 minutes to the hour here in London.
And it wouldn't be a good Saturday here on The Review without our weekly magazine review. And today we have another good pile of magazines in front of us. And to help us dissect them this week, we're joined in studio by John Walters, editor of I, which is the International Review of Graphic Design. Welcome, John.
Thank you for inviting me.
I see a nice nice pile of all sizes. I wonder if you can talk us through them. What's the first one you
have? Sure. Well, I'm going to start with perhaps the most obscure choice because it sold out within 48 hours, much to the surprise of its editor and designer. It's called Random Spectacular. And it's produced by...
Just pass it across, sorry.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you.
It's produced by a design studio called St. Jude's, who market a lot of limited edition prints of both contemporary and mid-century illustrators. Mm. And they decided to do a magazine, and actually all the profits went to charity. So it had a little kind of marketing push at the end of last year. And as I said, just to their surprise, using Facebook and Twitter and so on, they sold out very, very rapidly.
For our listeners, can you possibly just describe visually the impact?
It's quite a large format magazine on heavy uncoated paper. It's very strong on visuals, a lot of full page illustrations. It's veers towards there's no sense to be a very topical magazine. They're kind of timeless, quite interesting articles about illustrators and projects. And there's an interview with one of my favourite bloggers, The Gentle Author. Have you come across The Gentle Author?
No.
A guy who writes an article every day about living in the middle of Spitalfields in an old house and interviews sign painters or the local fishmonger, all kinds of interesting things.
It's an absolutely stunning production. And this is the first one they've done.
It's the only one they've done. And now I think buoyed by the success of this one, they're going to do it as a kind of occasional series, maybe one a year or maybe a couple a year.
So is there any idea how many they printed?
They just did an edition of 750.
Right.
And it just went.
I mean, what's wonderful about a project like this, and you open up, there's this absolutely beautiful story called Gin Palace Style, and the subline is the enduring charm of the Victorian pub, and it's written by William Brown. The illustrations are by Joanna Moore, and it just has this great sort of lyrical style, and it completely brings you into that environment.
I must say, Joanna Moore's illustrations are absolutely my favourite ones in the edition, and it reminds me a bit of that funny mixture of modernism and mid-century modernism with a nostalgia for Victorian pubs that you used to get in the Architectural Review. And that sort of championing, quite brutalist architecture alongside old engraved mirrors and the like, which seemed to come very naturally to those gentlemen.
Gillian, you're flipping through it now, but there's a great story in there called Fonts and Fish Cans, and it looks at the typography that was used in Jake Tilson's new cookbook. What's interesting about this type of project, isn't it, John, because... as you say, they've gone through, let's say, less traditional distribution channels, and because of the sellout, I imagine then the resale value already for it, because I would definitely go online now and try to buy it, because I need a copy of that.
This does have the feel of a collectible, and what I love about it, there's so much in our world of graphic design, high tech, and people think they have to push on the boundaries of technology, and this just seems the imagery, whether it's the photography or illustration, so crafted.
Well, of course, each new bit of technology that comes along liberates part of the old technology, and there's a very interesting article there by Phil Abel of Hand and Eye, the letterpress studio, saying that when people come to the studio, they get obsessed about, oh, isn't it great? It's handmade. And he says, no, I really like machines. He likes the old machines,
right?
And it's still about mass, it's about manufacturing and mass production, and it's just a.
But you
part
almost
of the history
smell
of that.
The ink when you look at this. You smell the ink.
You can
People often, people react to the latest edition of Eye saying it smells wonderful, and I find myself responding to this in the same way. It's a slightly different smell to Eye, but it's a good one.
Just before you came on a little bit earlier, we were talking to one of the new owners or the founders of a bookshop in Washington, Politics and Prose, and she was almost sort of defending the position of print and saying, she said if you land it from space, that you wouldn't even sort of know that there was any crisis around print. And it was oddly, because even earlier in the week, we were talking to some German publishers, German publishers of some scale who are here visiting us. And they said they think there's a real sweet spot in publishing now that, maybe the days of launching the magazine, which is going to have a circulation where you build a business plan, where you're going to come out and sell a million copies, is dead. But they felt that there's actually a wonderful let's say, heartland now in publishing, even on the quite commercial side, of magazines which will just do 70 or 80,000 copies. And maybe that's where the ambitions of big publishers need to be. And I'm wondering, are you sort of buoyed by just because, you know, there is a lot of print coming out, despite the doom and gloom?
I think we're in a fantastic era for print. And the actual technology of printing now, I mean, printers that we use, the business is booming, and they're constantly getting new bits of kit that really make the product better.
Mm.
So, which I'm also told in music is similar to using analog tape. You know, analog tape is better than it's ever been. It's just that people don't use it very much.
Mm. I see lots of nodding in the control room. I think everyone wants to go back to reel to reel here, and lots of razor blades.
But I gave a talk, went to a lovely design festival in Ljubljana, and they asked me to give a talk about that magazine production, because this is always on everyone's, welcome, representative of a dying industry.
Yes.
So, in a way, so you can go on the defensive. But I mean, my background is in music, and the analogy I used was that making a magazine is not the same as making vinyl. You know, to make a record, I mean, people still love records, but they're device dependent. You actually have to have a decent turntable and a needle and all that stuff. But picking up a magazine is more like going to a concert or a gig. You know, everyone can do it. You can just pick it up and you can read it. You don't need an iPad, you don't need a special bit of technology. You can bring your parents, you can bring your kids. You know, it's a very open thing. And I think going into a mag store like Magnation, you know, you're just talking to, it's just really simple. And it's the same way you go to a club. It's very much the same process that generations before. You go to a great club and you hear some great music. You know? So I feel that, you know, magazines are never going to die. It's just that the business model surrounding them changes all the time.
So what's the next magazine you're going to introduce us to?
Well, I'm going to... This is a really... I'm going to go to a magazine which is a lot more mainstream, but is also very niche in its ambitions and its process. And I think it's quite a quiet success story. That's Selvedge magazine, which is based around the culture of fabric, fashion, making things with fabrics, so upholstery and so on, and also the history and the illustrative aspect of those things. And this is very much not my kind of magazine, but I gave this as a subscription as a present for my wife a year ago, and she loves it, so it was another Christmas present.
Who produces it? What country?
It's in the UK. It's produced by a small team of people, I think based in North London. I think when they started, very, very similar to magazines like Little White Lies, they started by not really paying their contributors very much. But I think it's now evolved into a more professional thing. They've got good advertising. They have events. So there's a Selvedge brand, which is emerging. And again, it's very, very nicely printed and produced magazine. I think it's £8 on newsstands, £9.95 on newsstands now. I think they've defined a market and an audience, a readership, very cleverly, and they serve it very well. Were you familiar with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really interesting hybrid between being a real fan magazine and because, you know, it focuses on everything from, you know, embroidery, and there's, you know, specialist features on various fabrics, and it is, you know, there's bits of it as well which kind of remind you of an old Berta magazine as well. but then also they take you on sort of some of these historical treks. But yeah, it's an interesting combination, which this is why I find it fascinating, as I said, between being sort of, you know, very niche, fan-like, and then it's slightly academic at one turn, and then it's a bit DIY, and that's what's really lovely about it, because it's got this wonderful range when you go through it, and it's printed on it's a great matte stock that it's on, and it's, again, as you're saying, it's collectible. But I had a question for you, John. Do you regret giving your wife a subscription, because she might kind of whip up some odd bobble hat like you see in here? I mean, I don't want to wear all of the things that they're encouraging people to potentially make.
She hasn't actually made anything from this magazine yet. I think it's a more vicarious thrill.
I think, you know, is that part of it as well? Because, you know, they have a story.
In another life, she might have the time to...
when you buy a cooking magazine, you don't necessarily cook the recipes, but you love looking at them.
I mean, there's a wonderful piece in here called Thoroughly Modern Modesty. It says the allure of the new demure, and they've got this wonderful spread of, I would like to say, either Amish or Hutterite women, probably, photographed from behind, and then they they deconstruct, this type of sort of look and movement. And I could also see it's the type of title that probably more mainstream magazines as well would be looking to for inspiration.
I'm sure they do. Yes, and but it's totally non-patronizing. And
yeah.
It has a great tone of voice, and I think that every magazine is striving to get the tone of voice that's right for its readers.
What's next in the stack?
I'm going to pull out probably the most the least obscure magazine in my collection today, which is Sight and Sound magazine, the international film magazine, which has been going for forever.
Yes.
It's a BFI journal.
And you've got, who's on your cover?
Michael Fassbender.
Yes.
And do you have the...
This is the Cronenberg cover. It says Young and Freud on...
You've got the March one.
Wow. Yeah, I've got the March one already.
Wow, well done.
I know.
Yes, well, I have a subscription to this, but March hasn't showed up yet.
We're in the news gathering business here. But it was funny because this has come up from time to time, and you mentioned Little White Lies as favorite titles. Sight and Sound, you chose why? I mean, are you looking at it from a content point of view, or are you looking at it graphically? I mean, what appeals?
From a content point of view,
right.
Although I think it's edited and designed very well, but not in a kind of showy way. They're not trying to get graphic designers to buy, to make it an impulse buy for graphic designers or illustrators. It's really a lot of content about movies, and I think what's quite interesting about the balance is that it's kind of an industry magazine and a consumer magazine at the same time.
Yeah.
So you can read it as a film goer, which is the reason I read it, and often I'll keep it and I won't read stuff until I've actually seen the movie and like the movie. So, I may not waste my time reading something about a film director or actor that doesn't interest me until someone's dragged me along to see it, and I think, oh wow, I really need to read that feature.
So you want to post-rationalize it slightly.
I have to say though, given the visual nature and the storytelling nature of cinema, I do find it odd there aren't more inspired magazines up for covering film.
Well, there's some very mainstream mags, aren't there? Like Empire.
With very ugly design. I have to be careful when I say, but they're garish.
It's
not
to
my taste. I mean, I like, there's a slightly nerdy aspect to Sight and Sound as well, where you get all the credits. And so it's not so much post-rationalization as trying to figure out,
It's a bit of a decoding,
what
isn't
was
it?
That, that I saw. And so I kind of enjoy it on that level. And, for example, in this issue, there's a piece about Ken Russell. And you kind of expect Science Sound will do the great piece about Ken Russell, and the review. There's a sort of nicely dry sense of the reviews, and the captions are elegantly edited. So I enjoy that as a very straightforward mainstream magazine, and I get a subscription, so I don't. They just pile up, but clearly Tyler has a secret source. So.
Well, how do you feel about subscriptions? Because I can say as sort of a part media owner, it's a great thing to have, and it's a wonderful way of also engaging with with your core audience. But I only have a subscription. I mean, aside to it, of course, we have massive subscriptions or delivery service, the secret source, as it were, that comes into the office. But at home, the only thing I have is The Economist that comes to us. And I do get a subscription to this magazine just to make sure that the extra subscriptions are working fine. but aside from that, I want to go to the newsstand. And I have just enormous delight in just that notion of just going to peruse and
sense of discovery.
I don't know, what is it like for you?
Well, I've had this conversation over and over again because as the editor of
Do It Again,
and now part owner of an expensive magazine, it's difficult to get into regular newsstands. So I tend to be stocked in the more specialist places like the Tate Modern bookstore and Artwords in Rivington Street and so on, and the kind of cool places. But and I've had these conversations with designers who say, no, I have to go and buy it when it comes out, and then go to the coffee bar and read it, and bump into friends who like to see I've got it, And then we talked to a number of designers when we took the magazine independent, because we really wondered, is it worth all this trouble of trying to get the magazine into shops? And a lot of people, particularly young designers, said, yes, we really want to. Either it's a thing you want to go into the store when it comes out, or we want to pick and choose. We like the typography issue, we're not so keen on the illustration or something like that. But then again, the older designers tend to, busier maybe, like they get it at the office, or they get a regular subscription. And it's kind of that thing of, you know, my collection is intact. I'm not missing an issue. And I think there's several different relationships people have with magazines, and maybe people grow into subscriptions if it's a magazine they really love, having had those that kind of fling in the bookstore earlier on.
I mean, you just sometimes wish some of the magazine stores were a bit braver, because they would get more customers if they were stocking more independent magazines, that there was going to be that element of surprise and people could pick and choose instead of always having exactly the same magazines in exactly the same
space.
Well,
that's a whole other show that we could do on the curse of efficiencies, which is it's a horrible state for the news. And I was just going to say, what's funny is, you know, you can go to a very big chain in Sweden, for example, and it's much easier to find I in a lot of other markets than it would be at their equivalent brand in the UK, who shall remain nameless, but I think everyone knows who we're talking about. And that's I think the unfortunate thing, because as Gillian is saying, there's absolutely no sense of discovery. Just before we go, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask, when you look at work sent into you right now, John, and you know, whether it's typography, just, you know, whether it's fresh editions, what would you say, sort of, the whether it's a city or country, what's, you know, where's an interesting hotbed for you right now? Where are you seeing stuff bubbling up?
Oh, that's, well, I would say the really interesting things bubbling up are to do with the interface between digital and real world things, whether it's 3D printing or just finding interesting ways to kind of reinvent an older technology. Using apps or using Wi-Fi. And I think that there's a lot of very bright, smart people working in that area.
And any place in the world where you see that, perhaps that this is where it's bubbling up from? Or?
Well, the interesting thing is that the people working in that field are so interconnected that it almost doesn't matter where you are. Mm. But I'd say there's a lot of people in London, there's a lot of people stemming from the RCA courses. But then you've got someone like Robert Hodgin, who, he's just at the I.O. conference this weekend in the States, and I think he's in a little village somewhere, or maybe San Francisco. You know, it's kind of quite difficult to know where someone
is. Don't worry about that buzzer. We're not saying that time is up, but time is up, actually.
Sure. Well,
that was a fire alarm.
There's almost a sense that, you know, you're not always sure where someone is, and their neighbourhood is going on Twitter or on Facebook and swapping things around. Mm. So I don't what that means for the future, I don't know, because it can, sooner or later you do have to meet up and show people the stuff you're working on.
Absolutely, which we're all for. John Walters, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming
on a
Saturday afternoon. That's John Walters, editor of iMagazine. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We're heading off to Budapest next to talk to our Adam Labor right after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
A Monocle 24 Tag, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I'm into Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
24.
And you're back with Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian Dubias. It's just come up to 7 minutes to the top of the hour here in London.
An exhibition has opened recently in Budapest celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Raoul Wallenberg, a Swedish diplomat posted to Hungary. Wallenberg is widely recognized as saving tens of thousands of Jews from the Nazis near the end of the Second World War. Tragically, he disappeared in January 1945 and is presumed to have been killed in the gulags.
Our man in Budapest, Adam Labor, has seen the exhibition and he's joining us on the line now from the Hungarian capital. Hello, Adam.
Good morning. Good afternoon, rather.
Not at all. Tell us, how has this been, executed as an exhibition? And I guess there's been a lot of discussion. We've seen a lot of things in the newspaper. But, how is the narrative told of Raoul Wallenberg?
Oh, it's fairly straightforward. It sort of describes it from his time arriving in Budapest as a Swedish diplomat. And then he had this
very clever idea to extend Swedish diplomatic protection to both houses and to people. And in fact, the idea had originally been thought up by a Swiss diplomat called Karl Lutz, but Wallenberg kind of systematized it. And somehow he just pulled off this enormous bluff, because all he had was paperwork. And these pieces of paper with their little stamps and francs and pictures on were literally the difference between life and death.
And when you think about an exhibition of this scale, and I think also certainly the importance as it plays out, of course, in Central Europe, and even everything that's I think probably happening in the region today, is it told through photography? Is it memorabilia? I mean, what does the actual exhibition look like?
Well, it's mostly through photography. It's photographs of him, photographs of the period and of the time when he's there's quite a lot of material about. The winter of 1944 to 1945. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the fact that the government's put this exhibition on and is promoting it is that Wallenberg saved a lot of Jews from the Hungarian Nazis, because by that time, at the end of 44, early 45, the Germans had more or less given up on killing Jews, but the Hungarian Nazis were still very keen on it. So it's really part of a process here of coming to terms with what happened in the Second World War.
Wallenberg, obviously very important for Budapest and Hungary. I think a while back you were talking about the whole rebirth of a bit of a Jewish community in Budapest, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I mean, what's interesting, I mean, partly because, in fact, of Wallenberg, the main ghetto in Budapest in 1944 was saved by the Red Army. The Germans wanted to exterminate all the people in it, but Wallenberg persuaded them not to do that. So about 100 to 120,000 people survived. And that's been the nucleus of a revival of Jewish culture in Budapest, especially among younger people. And then it's not really so much a religious revival as a kind of revival of culture and identity, because Hungary's actually got the third largest Jewish community on mainland Europe after Paris, after France and after Germany. But many of the Jews in France came from North Africa, and many of the Germans Jews came from Russia, in the last 10 or 20 years. So it's like the last indigenous kind of Jewish population.
And in this area, what kind of things are you seeing coming up in terms of enterprise and culture?
Well, you're seeing a lot of festivals. Every year there's, they call it quarter six, quarter seven, Hanukkah festival, around the festival of Hanukkah, which usually falls in November or December. And there's things like theatre performances, cultural readings, bars sort of dedicate the night to a Jewish theme. So the kind of the significance of that is that it's open and it's becoming part of the city's culture, whereas under communism this wasn't really encouraged. And in the first few years after the changes, people were still kind of nervous about public expressions of Jewish life. But it's much more confident now. And it's mainly among young people in their 20s and their 30s.
Great. Adam Labor in Budapest. Look forward to seeing you. I think it's 2 weeks from now. We'll probably be having the Dobosh Tort, which I'm really looking forward to. So you have to find the best Dobosh Tort cafe for
I've
us.
I've already found it for you, Tyler.
Excellent. Okay. Wonderful. Have a great weekend. That was Adam Labor in Budapest. And that exhibition, There Is No Other Choice For Me, by Raoul Wallenberg, 1912 to 2012, will be at the Hungarian National Museum until the 12th of February before it goes on to Moscow, Berlin, Tel Aviv, Washington, New York, Ottawa, and Toronto. You're listening to Monocle 24. And we are almost out of time. That brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. Today's show, I think for a first, was produced by Katie Bilboa. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our sound engineer was Alex Funnell. We are going to be coming back with the news very shortly, and also the curator, and of course the weekly is going to be here. Is it not, Gillian?
It is.
Yes. I just saw Mr. John Eskin walk into the studio, which means that news is going to be coming up in about 1 minute's time. That's all from the review. Goodbye.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.